As I said at the top of the program, Paula Poundstone was not on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this past weekend, but we are going to make up for it on today's program and later this week when she appears at the Sheldon. She's a busy lady on the road, on the radio, and hopefully soon on the bestseller list. Her latest book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, will be out in May. Paula Poundstone, whom Comedy Central calls one of the top 100 comics of all time, joins us by phone. Paula, so nice to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I don't think that top 100 list, they say of all time, but, you know, there's no, like, Cro-Magnon. There's no, I'm not sure they're really covering all time.
Well, how far back can we go, I wonder?
Yeah, I mean, my guess is, by the way, I wish there would be some sort of scientific study about when, you know, when humor came on the scene. But my guess is it got them through some long, cold cave nights.
I would have to think that was probably called for.
Yeah, it's the best thing in the world for your mental health.
No question.
Exercise, sure, definitely. But, you know, laughter, I find during these fractious times, it's so good to get together and laugh. And it's different, by the way. Anybody who types in LOL is lying. Nobody, you don't LOL when you're by yourself looking at a small screen. You laugh a lot when you're with a group of people and you're caught up in those, you know, wonderful waves of laughter that nature gave us.
You're actually calling these fractious times?
Mm. Yeah, I hope that's not too partisan.
No. Well, you know, I wanted to bring that up because I read something recently, that an interview that you'd given, in which you pointed out the strongest emotions for you right now are happiness and fear. And I suspect the fear part is the political side of things.
Yeah, it is. Plus the rise of just sort of the rise of hate crimes. You know, I'm an atheist, so surely they're coming for us. But just this sort of hair trigger feeling about our fellow men is troubling at best. And I do think, you know, being a comic, and I want everyone who comes to the show to have a good time. That's my goal for the night. It's pretty simple, pretty basic. Just for everybody to have fun, everybody to laugh. One of the best kinds of laughter. When my son was young one day, it dawned on him that I talk about him on stage. And when he asked me point blank, I was kind of busted, you know. And I said, yeah, I do, honey. And I said, well, I just want to say two things. I said, first of all, sometimes I exaggerate. Although, in truth, you don't have to exaggerate very much with him. But I said, sometimes I exaggerate to make it funny. And I said, but the other thing is, sometimes what I'm saying, even though it seems unique to us, is so universal, right? The struggles that he and I, you know, were suffering through, so universal. I said, if we were the only ones, then people would just look at me funny. But in fact, people laugh because they go, oh my God, I have that. Or I remember when, you know, or I remember when we were going through that. Or, oh my gosh, I have a son who's, you know, younger and looks like we're headed in that direction. There's that laughter of familiarity that really does unite everybody. You know, the truth is we have far more in common than we have differences, and the sooner we figure that out, the better off we'll be. And our success, be it our happiness, our financial success, our, you know, the richness of our lives, depends on people who don't look anything like us. That's, you know, that's just a fact, and it's been proven over and over again. So nights of laughter I find very, very, you know, very, very healing in this time. Having said that, I know sometimes I'm a Democrat, and I definitely skew Democrat when I talk. I probably have a fairly slim margin of Republicans who come to see me. But the other night I was someplace, and I did some Trump jokes. Now, listen, I could be on stage. I could be in the audience. And somebody could do some Hillary jokes, and if I thought they were funny, I would laugh. I don't think I would feel, you know, terribly offended. And the truth is, the Trump people won, so they, you know, they're laughing all the way to the bank. I don't know why they'd be so touchy. But I did a couple of Trump jokes, and there were people, they might have been about the fifth row in. I was in Wilmington, North Carolina. And they stood up. This were like four of them. They just stood up, and they said, good Bye. And they stormed out. Now, if I was not enjoying a show for whatever reason, I think I would quietly slip out. I don't think I would need to make a fuss of it. Because, you know, it's the truth is it's my turn with the microphone when I'm on stage. Yeah. And that's just the way it is. That's just how the dynamic works on that night. But anyway, these people stormed out. There was, so I didn't say anything about it right away. I just sort of proceeded with what I was saying. And then after a little while, I go, okay, are they gone? And then we started, you know, I sort of asked the audience about what they were saying before. We started sort of laughing about the incident and stuff like that. And a couple different people down front, I forget why they said this. I don't think I said, are there any other Republicans here? I don't think I said that. Because I don't much care. But two different people, one in the first row and one in the second row, said to me, I'm a Republican. The other one said, I'm a Republican. We had, I ended up sort of interviewing them, which I do in my show anyways. I do a lot of talking to individuals in the audience just because it's fun and it makes every show different. And it sort of generates where I go next. We had so much fun laughing. Me and these people with whom I would vote differently.
And yet this is sort of atypical of your performances, isn't it, taking on politics? I've always heard that you kind of back away from that or had.
Not true. No. It depends. You know, the truth is my act is largely autobiographical.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people say to me, and I find this a very odd backhanded compliment, but sometimes people say to me, they go, oh, you know, we like you because you don't talk about sex. And I go, okay, my act is largely autobiographical. I don't have sex. That's why I don't talk about sex. Not because I find it verboten. Not because I think there's something offensive about the topic. It's just that I mostly talk about my own life, and that just simply doesn't come up. The level to which I talk about the world outside of my own personal life is really dictated by the level of drama in my own personal life, because I watch the news as much as I can. I get the New York Times, and it is now in a week-long stack in my bedroom. There are times where I have a lot of time to look into the world outside of myself, and there are times where I have a very limited time and I know very little about the world outside of myself, and that is reflected in my act. So when I was just plain in the trenches with my son, who suffers from very severe electronics addiction, which is a real thing, I barely knew a thing about what was going on in the rest of the world, because I was just nose to the grindstone every day dealing with, you know, our personal problems. And then as that responsibility left my shoulders and was now squarely on his, I pay more attention. And the other thing is, since Trump has been in office, I think most of us in the country live and breathe Trump. And he, I don't know if it's like an evil genius that he's created that on purpose, or if it's personality disorder. I personally think that there's some pretty strong mental health problems there. But the truth is, that's the way the news runs mostly now, too. I find myself, I'll glance at the CNN website sometimes, and if there's not a Trump story, I guess I don't pay as much attention sometimes. Because with the CNN website,
sure.
If they're not a Trump story, they're telling you that Jennifer Aniston turned 50, as if that's news.
Well, his tendency to draw crowds on television is one in the presidency. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah, and so I guess in that way I have a tremendous amount in common with my fellow man, because I am drawn. You know, there are days where when he doesn't say anything nutty, I feel a little empty. You know, there is, you know, you almost become addicted to the just the craziness. If none of it was real and it was just an HBO miniseries, right, I would binge watch, because it's fascinating. The problem is that it's real and it has real impact, which is just too damn bad. But if it wasn't, if it was just a story that somebody made up and now they're telling it and there's a, you know, orange-haired guy who, you know, kind of takes over the country and blah, 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 my God, it would be fascinating. It would be so much fun to watch. And you'd watch that main character and roar with laughter. Unfortunately, it's not coming down quite that way.
You know, you mentioned earlier, Paula, that you draw a lot from your audiences when you perform. And that I read that most of your shows are not the same as the one just before it. Do you prepare for a city like St. Louis differently, trying to think of what the city is like, what the people are like, and kind of tailor your presentation accordingly?
No, because that would require the E word, effort. no, which Poundstone shun as a rule. I've spent a little teeny bit of time in St. Louis, not enough that I would know any particular building other than the Arch. I have cousins from there, and so we, you know, I think it was the first time I went to a Shakey's, but it was many years ago. And I'm not sure, by the way, that that's anything that a city should be known for. But I largely am in and out everywhere that I go. I fly in. You know, and because I'm coming from the West Coast, the time zones are working against me. So, you know, I usually fly in and have enough time to get a quick nap, take a shower, eat some dinner, and go tell my jokes. And then I leave a few short hours later, actually, because I take the first flight out of everywhere that I am. So I don't spend time. I'm not a tourist. The only thing I ever know about a place, for the most part, is... I don't know, whatever a driver may tell me on the way in from the airport, or whatever the, you know, the person from the theater who picks me up tells me on the way from the hotel to the venue. Sometimes, by the way, that sometimes they tell me these really funny things, and somehow it's a great part of the night. But for the most part, the way I learn about where I am is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge. And 80% of the time, I would say, I'll say to someone, "Are, you know, do you live in St. Louis? Or, you know, do you live in blah, 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 whatever city I'm from?" And they may say yes, and then they may tell me what neighborhood. Or perhaps they say no, and they tell me a town, you know, just to the left of St. Louis or whatever. And the whole crowd goes like, ugh. Because every place, I don't care, I don't care where you live. You could live in, you know, the Swampville suburb of hell, and there is a whipping boy town right nearby. Everywhere you are, somebody finds some sort of judgment about a place, you know, just across the way from them. And so I learn about the area usually just from talking to audience members. Or they work at a place that everybody knows about or whatever. And so these little, yeah, these little biographies emerge, and that's kind of what I set my sails from.
And, you know, it reminds me a little bit of Jonathan Winters to this degree. I know that he had a Broadway run years ago in which basically he just took stuff from the audience and ran with it, and that was his, the show was different every night. Were you influenced at all by Jonathan Winters?
Don't I wish.
Well, yeah.
I actually was just reading Dick Cavett had a book come out, was it 2 years ago or so, called Brief Encounters. This is a series of essays that he's written, but one of the essays was about Jonathan Winters. And I saw him when I was growing up, and I remember that, you know, anytime we knew he was going to be on something, me and my siblings were always excited to see him because he was so damn funny. But I didn't see, like, tons of him. I never saw him on stage. But Dick's description of what, you know, of the way that he worked, must be the envy of all of every comic alive. Because Jonathan could go not just from subject to subject and circumstance to circumstance, but he could go from character to character.
Oh, yes.
And Robin was very influenced by him and was the first to say so.
Robin Williams, who, of course, is, I guess we can call him a mentor of yours.
He was a mentor of mine. I have a I have a little framed picture of him right beside my bedroom door. I salute it every time I come and go. Robin, I firmly believe no one my generation of comic or younger would be working at all were it not for Robin Williams. He really, I mean, stand-up comedy, as we talked about earlier, has been around since we came out of the caves, I'm sure. But there was a waning interest in it, I think, prior to Robin. There were some comics that were working, but not a lot. The whole sort of comedy club circuit thing didn't even exist until Robin came around. He really reignited audiences' interest in the form of stand-up comedy. And really, more than any individual I can think of in almost any industry, he did it all over the country.
Yeah.
He would be working at like a 3,000-seat amphitheater somewhere, and then that night he would show up at Uncle Funny's Yuck House to tell some more jokes. And so what happened was, those of us working, I mean, I met him in San Francisco, and he was a big reason that San Francisco had such a great and thriving comedy scene in the 80s. But it was literally all over the country. There was always this almost palpable feeling that Robin Williams might stop by.
Hmm.
And the truth is, no matter how obscure the little comedy hut you were in, by golly, he might have. Every club somewhere in the back has a picture of Robin Williams on their stage framed in the manager's office.
You know, I remember a 60 Minutes episode of some years ago in which Ed Bradley was interviewing Jonathan Winters, and unbeknownst to either of them, Robin Williams showed up, and he and Winters went at it. You know, it was one of the funniest pieces of television I've ever seen. It was totally extemporaneous. Can you imagine that?
He really could do that, you know?
Yeah.
Could do it for lots and lots of reasons, but he really could do that. And so then what happened was, I think while people were waiting to maybe get a chance to see Robin, they happened to see the rest of us.
Yeah.
And you know, and some of that took root.
Tell us quickly, we've only got a couple of minutes left, about your book. It's coming out in May, The Unscientific Study of the Search for
Happiness. The Unscientific Study of the Search for
Happiness.
That's
right. Right. It's such a long title, I read over the first couple of words.
I know. You know, when it gets shipped, they cautioned me about this from the start. You know, the publishers were concerned about the length of the title. They said, well, when it gets shipped, you know, they don't print the whole title on the label. So it's probably going to be shipped under the title of The Totally Un, which is fine with me. My book is a series of experiments doing things that I or other people thought would make me happy. And my plan from the very start was not just to do the experiment, which I do, and each chapter is written as an experiment, but the analysis part is are there any lasting effects of whatever it is I may have done, whatever was the variable in the experiment? Are there any lasting effects of that when I return to my regular life? So in essence, it's certainly memoir-ish. I tell the story of, it took me 7 years to write that book, so I tell the story of 7 years of raising my children and being a stand-up comic and the daily struggle of just being me. And its number one job is to be funny, and I think I pulled that off, and here's why. You know, you have to do this horrible process where you get blurbs.
Yeah, we have 30 seconds.
I sent it to Dick Van Dyke asking for a blurb, and Dick did give me one, but his wife wrote me back and told me that he quotes the book around the house. So I feel I'm in solid footing.
Not bad company right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
a guy for whom Carl Reiner wrote for many, many years.
Sure.
And so he knows from good writing.
We will be looking forward to the book, and also looking forward to you, Paula Poundstone, when you come to St. Louis this weekend, appearing at the Sheldon on Saturday. And hope you have a full house. You deserve it. You're a very funny lady.
Well, thank you so much. It was nice talking with you. You take care.
You too. The book, once again, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness by Paula Poundstone. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.